the State of Florida Sports Podcast, presented by the USA Today Network. Here's your host, Tim Walters.
It's been called the fifth major, and this year it celebrates its 50th anniversary. The Players' Championship was first played at Atlanta Country Club in Marietta, Georgia in 1974. It was played the following year in Texas, then moved to South Florida in 1976. In 1977, it moved to Ponte Vedra Beach near Jacksonville and has been played in that city ever since. Since 1982, it's been held at TPC Sawgrass. On this week's podcast, Gary Smits of the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville will be here to talk about the Players' Championship as it marks its golden anniversary. He's covered this tournament for more than four decades, and he'll be joining us in just a moment. Hello again, everybody. I'm Tim Walters, and thank you once again for joining me on the State of Florida Sports Podcast, powered by the USA Today Network. This podcast utilizes our Florida Sports Network of beat writers, columnists, and some special guests to bring you up to speed on the most important sports topics. Our Florida network consists of 17 news sites that encompass the state. We encourage you to subscribe to your hometown newspaper and, of course, this podcast to help support the incredible journalism done by our talented staffs. When you see Gary Smits walking around TPC Sawgrass, you might mistake him for the mayor. Everybody knows Gary, and you can't miss him in his signature ornate shirts. Let's bring him in now to talk about this year's players. Gary, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Well, you've been doing some great work around the players. We've been planning this thing for quite some time. You started rolling out stories last week. But first, I don't want to talk about what's going to happen this week. I want to talk about what's going to happen 50 years from now on the 100th anniversary of the players. You've done some great reporting looking at what this thing might look like 50 years from now in 2074. So tell the audience what you've learned.
Well, I've talked to people such as equipment manufacturing representatives, digital people in the digital department at the Players' Championship, both the social media and the digital TV product, and the agronomist, the head agronomist at the TPC Sawgrass, and ask him, just be a little bit forward thinking, expand your imagination. There are no crazy ideas, but what do you think the product professional golf will look like, both for the in-home TV viewer and the spectator on the ground of the golf course? And we're getting some, people are having fun with it. And I think to some of it may sound pretty outlandish, but Tim, you know, I'm not sure the general public knows it. You know, if you and I had to, we could go to a rest stop on the interstate, take our phone out, and write a complete story on our phone and get it posted on our website with photos and video if we had to. And so who would have imagined that even 20 years ago, let alone 50? So I think the most interesting thing that I found was what the televised product is going to look like. For example, the prediction by Scott Gutterman of the PGA Tour digital department is that your TV is going to be holographic. It's going to be wherever you want it. You know, the kitchen, the living room, your bedroom, your back porch, your garage, and you're going to have little tiny cameras throughout your house, and you will have a very, very small remote control that turns it on and off. And after that, you just kind of reach out and touch the hologram to change channels, things like that. But you literally could have a hologram of your best friend who lives across the country sitting next to you on the couch. And you guys are arguing over this putt that somebody should or should not have made, or for that matter, could be any sports, you know, should the coach have gone for it at that point. And the only thing your friend can't do, or you can't do for your friend, is get each other a beer from the refrigerator. So it's very interesting, and just the description of what TV equipment used to televise a sporting event. You literally, one gentleman told me that you could have 15 or 20 drones, cameras about the size of a mosquito, hovering over top of the players in the fairway and giving you every conceivable angle and shot. The players will be able to make their own equipment in 3D printers. You know, you won't have to have these huge equipment trucks at tour events taking up an entire parking lot. And the players have to go get, you know, if they need their putter tweaked, a little bit longer shaft in their driver, you know, they'll be able to do it in a 3D printer. And they're already making putters in 3D printers now. So it very rudimentary, and it's not exactly, you know, a world-class piece of equipment. But, you know, who knows what you'll be able to do 50 years from now.
Well, you know, when you talk about the, you know, mini cameras flying over people, and when you talk about things like that, virtual people sitting with you, I mean, I'm picturing a world where you can bring up your menu and just pick which player you want to watch. That way, you don't only see what television's showing you. Like, you can kind of pick your menu of player. Did anyone mention things like that? Because I'm picturing this, like, Iron Man type thing where he brings up the screen in front of him and he's clicking on his menu, and, you know, where golf caddies look like R2-D2 and they're rolling behind you. So did they talk about some of those aspects?
Yes, that's pretty much where we're heading in that regard. And they're also talking about the spectators around the 18th or the 17th hole, the Island Green at the Players Championship. There won't be any scoreboards, but there'll be holographic images literally just up in the sky that people will be able to see of whoever's on the green and what his percentage of making that putt from that distance has been over his entire career. And then, you know, for the gambling purposes, I pointed out that you could actually have a pair of sunglasses that would give you a readout of what the latest odds are for somebody to win, or even prop bets. And all you'd have to do is maybe tap the glasses once to make a bet, you know, twice to double down, you know, whatever the heck. It's kind of nuts. And you mentioned Iron Man. You know, there's a lot of amazing things that have happened in movies of science fiction that have actually come true. I mean, who can forget when flip phones were very popular with guys? They were popular because that's what the communicators were in Star Trek. That's exactly why. And that's why flip phones are actually making a little bit of a comeback, because guys loved it because it was in Star Trek. So it's going to be pretty amazing. I talked to the NBC golf producer, Tommy Roy, who said that, sad to say, that the man who sits in his seat 50 years from now might not even have to be on site at the golf course. He'll be in the PGA Tour Productions building, which is about maybe a quarter of a mile away from the 17th hole. And he said, you know, he said that is kind of sad, but that's where they're going. And there won't be this big production truck. There'll just be a little room. We'll have a couple of computers in front of them, and you'll be able to communicate with anybody out there on the golf course. And it's going to be pretty fascinating. And, but then you look at golf 50 years from now, when the players started in 1974, and the equipment the guys used and the number of cameras are out on the golf course, they were only televising the last four holes. It was an hour and a half broadcast of professional golf back then, because the technology they could only do four holes. They really couldn't. They didn't have the capability to spread out over the entire course like they're doing now. So who knows what they'll have in store for us. And as much as we tried to imagine this, I think if we can see into the future, we'll see that they were able to accomplish even more.
Well, yeah, a couple of things you mentioned in there. You know, I'm picturing, you know, as we mentioned, you're going to be getting all of this information coming in. You're going to be able to watch all these things. I can't imagine being a broadcaster. I mean, they may have to have people discussing what each golfer is doing, or maybe they use AI, or there's a robotic voice giving you that information. So who knows, you know, what the role of broadcasters are going to be. You mentioned the gambling, even quicker, easier ways to lose money, which I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. And, you know, I'm also picturing, you know, like golf carts that look like, you know, like the speeders in Star Wars. That way, you know, they're hovering and using air and not leaving tire tracks and things on the golf course. So it's going to be exciting, Gary. I mean, 50 years from now, that's, you know, it's crazy to think about. But you mentioned things that we see now were unimaginable 20 years ago. So, you know, it's exciting. So, you know, make sure that you go to jacksonville.com to check out all of the great work that Gary did on this, so you can read about all this futuristic stuff. But, you know, Gary, now I want to talk about this year's tournament, the 50th anniversary. And, you know, we released the field on Friday. Scottie Scheffler is the defending champion. You know, no one's ever won this tournament in back-to-back years, and there's only a few guys that have even won it multiple times. So are you surprised that that's never been accomplished?
Yes, because the players are this good, and there have been a you know, just a ton of guys. I mean, when you figure Jack Nicklaus has won this three times, Tiger Woods has won it twice, you know, other past champion, Phil Mickelson, you know, Adam Scott, guys who are in the Hall of Fame, guys who will be in the Hall of Fame. Because you took it, you look at the four majors, the Masters, the British Open, the PGA, and the US Open, and there have been repeat winners in those tournaments well within the current history of the Players' Championship multiple times. I mean, Tiger has gone back-to-back at the PGA, the British, and the Masters. Now, the U.S. Open is a little bit tougher. Curtis Raines went back-to-back in 88 and 89, and Tiger has done that also. But the nature of the Players' Championship, you can find there are weak links in every field in the majors. For example, in the Masters, it's only between 80 and 90 players, and you have 10 or 12 past champions and 6 or 8 amateurs that have no chance. So now you only got to beat 60 guys, essentially. The U.S. Open, you have local and sectional qualifiers. You have college kids. You have career amateurs. The British Open is the same thing when you go over there. In a PGA championship, you've got 20 club pros in the field. So all of those fields are watered down a little bit. The field of the Players' Championship from 1 through 144, you have to have accomplished something within the past year or so or two. You've had to have won. You've had to have been the top 125 on the FedEx Cup points list the year before. You have to be in the top 70 this year. So it's in the category of what have you done for me lately, the entire field of the PGA Tour is these guys have done something for you lately. And so the number of whatever judgment call you want to use to decide, okay, who's the worst guy in the field? That guy can still win this tournament. The worst player in the field of the other four majors has zero chance of winning that tournament. So now you talk about it, it's an increased level of competition. There's more guys you've got to beat. You've got to beat 143 other guys. Now you go to the golf course, and you have a golf course that was designed and built by Pete Dye with under the directions of former PGA Tour Commissioner Dean Beaman, to not favor any particular style of play. As the NBC producer Tommy Roy told me, this golf course does not care about you, about players. They don't care if you're long. They don't care if you're a great putter. They don't care if you've got a great short game. What it does care about is you've got to be able to do all of those things at some point, with the possible exception of being a very long hitter, because you have had guys like Fred Funk, who won in 2005, who was historically among the shortest drivers on a PGA Tour. Tom Kite did not drive it a long way. Stephen Ames did not hit it a long way. Tim Clark did not hit it a long way, and they all won Players' Championships. So you got to have everything working at the same time, and you got to beat a lot of guys in this field who all have earned their way in here through recent accomplishments, at least within the past couple of years. And for the vast majority of them are playing well right now.
Yeah, well, you know, Gary, I think a collective groan went out across the media landscape, across the country, across Jacksonville, and even amongst golf executives on Friday when we found out that Tiger Woods would indeed not be coming to the Players. This was his fifth and final year of eligibility. So what are your thoughts on Tiger not being here for the 50th anniversary?
Well, it was a little bit of a disappointment, especially when he did not enter Bay Hill this week, a tournament he's won 8 times, and everybody thought, well, that Tiger had a stated goal of playing once a month leading up to the Masters. And he played in L.A., played one round, then he got the flu the next day and withdrew. So I thought, oh, okay, there's a good chance he's going to play in this. It's not going to make a difference to the what's going on at the tournament as far as attendance goes, because Friday and Saturday parking was already sold out before we knew Tiger was not going to play. The military tickets, 22,000 of them, are all sold out. And it's going to be, they're going to be rocking and rolling out there next week. Tiger brings TV ratings. There's no question about that they go up when Tiger is in the field. But everybody else is in this field. The only player in the top 10 who's not here is number 3, Jon Rahm, who the minute he went to LIV Golf in December, he came under PGA Tour suspension, as are the rest of the LIV players. There are 46 of the top 50 players in the world here, minus Rahm, Cameron Smith, Tyrrell Hatton, and Brooks Koepka, who are all playing on LIV Golf. and we've got 85 of the top 100 in the world here. So Tiger's not here. The live guys aren't here, but everybody else who is a among the stars worldwide on not only the PGA Tour, but the DP World Tour. And we've even got a couple of guys from the Japanese Tour who had a high enough world golf ranking to be here. And so it's, like I said, there's a couple of guys not here, but everybody else is.
Yep. Well, you know, and a lot of these guys, they have a chance to win the most money that the Players Championship will ever dole out this year. I guess it was last year and this year, but, you know, $25 million, the winner gets $4.5 million. You wrote about the progression of this tournament, Gary. And in 1974, the first winner took home $50,000. Do you know roughly what that would be in today's purchasing power? Because I looked it up. Take a guess.
Probably in the neighborhood of $400,000.
That's a pretty good guess. So $50,000 in 1975 is equivalent to about $286,632.90. So still nowhere near the ridiculous amount. So, you know, why has this tournament been able to make this purse so large? And why is it important to keep it that large, especially when you have lots of tournaments in Florida in March?
Yeah, well, they are professionals and they do play for money. So the money is going to get their attention. And that was one thing the former commissioner, Gene Beamon, who had the concept of this tournament. He created it because he thought that the PGA Tour, which supplies most of the talent to the other majors and the other events, should have its own championship. It's as simple as that. And he said one of the things he had to do to get the players' attention was to offer the biggest purse. Now, when it first started, that $50,000, there were a couple of tour events that had a $50,000 first prize. I think the total purse is $250,000. And there was one in the early years, the World Series of Golf perhaps might have given $60,000. But starting when this tournament moved to the TPC Sawgrass in 1982, they made it a point to offer the largest purse in golf. And in some cases, people have made the case they're artificially pumping money into this to make sure of that, and that they were trying to buy themselves major championship status. The tour didn't really care, and certainly the players don't care as they're looking at that direct deposit the Tuesday following the final round, which is about what everybody's direct deposit is from whatever you won the week before. So, it's, you know, progressed, and as TV contracts have gotten better and tournament attendance has gotten better and the interest in golf has gotten more, especially since Tiger Woods, purses have kind of bumped up even more, to the point where we are now. Some guys don't play for money. You know, Tiger never played for money because when he came out of college, he signed a multi-million dollar deal with Nike and he was not hurting from the get-go. So he was all about competition. He just wanted to beat everybody's butt every tournament he teed it up in. And some of these guys are fixated on money, but not all of them. And a lot of them just want to come out there and beat the best in the world. And the money is a nice little bonus. But the only time since it moved to the TPC that has not been the biggest purse in golf was there was a couple of years where Fox got the U.S. Open contract. And they bumped the U.S. Open up a little bit higher than the Players. The Players caught up in a couple of years, and now the U.S. Open is back on NBC, and the PGA Tour is kind of able to make sure that they pay more than Fox because NBC is one of their TV partners. So it's the interesting part about that is if you make the cut and then finish dead last, you're going to make about what Jack Nicklaus made in 1974.
It seems like I need to be a top-notch but last-place golfer. I think I could survive on that type of money. Well, yeah. You know, Gary, you also, one of the things we have up at jacksonville.com right now is you did a nice hole-by-hole breakdown where you not only kind of gave the specs and a little bit about each hole, but you ranked them in terms of difficulty. Now, I had Fred Funk on this podcast last week, and hopefully everyone listening to this listened to that. If not, go back and check it out. But he mentioned that he liked hole number 4, but not hole number 8. And, you know, based on your rankings, you know, hole number 4 is the fifth hardest hole out there, but he liked that one. Hole number 8 is your third hardest. So, you know, he actually said he liked the famed number 17. He said he didn't struggle hitting it in the water. He struggled putting on the little island green. But, you know, which one did you rank number 1? I was surprised by, well, not surprised, it's just when you see where it fell, which is number 1 and why is that one ranked as such?
Well, historically, the most difficult hole in this course is number 18. It's a long dogleg left par 4 hole. It's got water all the way down the left-hand side. It's got trees down the right. Most players, and this could be guys like me who are about the 16 handicaps to the best players in the world. Sometimes when you get nervous, you block it out to the right, which puts it in the trees, or you hook it, which goes in the water. We have had two Players Championship winners, Adam Scott in 2004 and Cameron Smith in 2022, who hit their second shots at 18 into the water and somehow made a bogey to win by one. So that hole will get you when it's tight. And it was set up to be difficult. And Pete Dye wanted the hardest hole on the course to be the last hole to really test you. Now, before that, you've got 16, which is a reachable par 5 and historically plays as the easiest hole on the course. And they saw that as a chance to play catch-up ball and move up, maybe, you know, tie for the lead or get into the lead. Then you got to go to 17, which is not really a hard shot. Lee Trevino once said about the 17th hole, the island green, that if the green was the same size and it was surrounded by just rough, that everybody would hit the green. But prove positive that the water around that can get into their heads just like it gets into our heads. And there have been some disasters at that hole. Bob Tway made a 12 on that hole in 2005 and 9 over, which is difficult. Robert Gomez once made an 11. And one player told me that when you hit a couple of balls in the water, you start to feel like you're playing naked. You have one of those dreams where you wake up and you're undressed completely and you don't know where to go. And that's how tough that hole can be. It's interesting that Fred brought up 4, and I'm surprised actually that the stats show that 4 has played that difficult. It's not a hard drive. It's a short hole, but they've got a two-tiered green that really slopes hard from right to left. There's water in front of the left-hand side of that green. And on Sunday, they like to put the pin on the left-hand side. Now, sometimes guys that hit in the middle of the green, you'll catch the slope and it'll roll down and go in the hole. There have been more 2s on that hole than any par 4 on the course, but there's also been a 12 on that hole by an unfortunate soul named Philip Hancock in 1985, who kept pumping balls in the water. So the first hole is everybody plays for par. The second hole, par 5, everybody plays that for birdie. The third hole is a pretty difficult par 3. You want a par there. And 4 is a hole that you want a birdie because the 5, 6, 7, 8 stretch is pretty difficult on the course. And 8, when we're talking about how hard that is, that's the longest par 3 on the course. And if the rules officials are feeling evil, in other words, if the wind is not in their face too much of the players, they can make that hole about 240 yards and make them hit 5 wood off the tee to a fairly small green with a lot of trouble around it.
Yeah, and you know, I love about 18, the hardest hole, the quote you have from Mark McCumber, who was also on this podcast last year, so everybody go look that up. But the 1988 Players Championship champion was asked, how do you play number 18? And his answer, with a 2-shot lead. I love that. Yeah. So, you know, me personally, one of my favorite holes there, Gary, and maybe I'm a little bit homerish about this, I just love number 1 because I love watching a new group go out and tee off and kind of begin their journey. I don't even, get that excited about 10 because I know some groups start, you know, on 10, but there's just something about that number 1 hole. Is there one that you just enjoy watching people play more than the others?
Well, I'm with you on that. I like watching 1 and they used to have big, large spectator mounds behind 1 that they've now gotten rid of because they were too hard to maintain. But there's still more than enough room to stand around there and watch guys tee off. And 1 and 10 are actually intended to be fairly similar, except 1 is a little bit of a dogleg left and 10 is a little bit of a slight dogleg right. But they're about the same distance. They're both par 4s. One of Pete Dye's design philosophies is if you're playing tournament golf on these and on Thursday and Friday, half the field is going to tee off on 1 and half is going to tee off on 10. You need his holes to not be a competitive disadvantage or advantage by being too much easier or too much harder than the other one. So 1 and 10 are kind of the same test. But if I would advise fans to go out to play other than 16, 17, 18, there's two spots that I like. One is behind the second green, where you can watch guys try to reach that green and two on a par five. And there's a lot of pop bunkers, a lot of areas where you're going to see some pretty creative short game shots. And then you can shift a little bit over to your left, and you'll be at the third tee, literally walking across the cart path. They're that close, and you can see some tee shots there. The other area I like is the 11th green. It's a par five, and very scenic, very picturesque, watching guys come in from behind the green, and there's water in front of that. And then you shift again over a little bit to your right, and you got the 12th tee, and that hole is made a drivable par four. It's only about 300 yards, and you can watch guys see just how frisky they want to get in trying to get on there. There have been a few eagles on the 12th hole where guys have driven on a green and made a putt for an eagle, but there's also some water to the left. So if you overcook the hook out there, then you can go in the water there. So if you're looking for a couple of spots outside of the obvious around 17, go to between 2 and 3 and between 11 and 12. That's my favorite spots.
Yeah. And I always camp out to watch several guys on 17 too. Cause, boy, I just look at it and think to myself, if I tried that, I would hit the ball in the water every single time. I'm amazed and tickled every time somebody actually gets it on the putting green. Although those guys,
I bat about 500 putting that on the green.
There you go.
I've had some good shots at them, and I've had a couple of times. And you know what? When you're playing there as a recreational golfer or as a resort guest, you're only supposed to, if you hit two tee shots in the water, you're supposed to move on. They don't want you to keep pumping while at the ball in the water.
Yep. Well, and I love watching that and heading into the hardest hole. So 17th's not even the hardest hole. So make sure to read that story by Gary Smits. And that's Gary with two R's, by the way, G-A-R-R-Y Smits. But, you know, Gary, the tournament is slated to end on March 17th, which is, of course, St. Patrick's Day. At least we hope it's going to end then. We'll talk about weather in a second. But first, you know, you're going to be writing a story that's going to be running next weekend looking at our Irish golfers. So, you know, we don't want to give away too much because we want people to go read it. Of course, Rory being one of them. But what can you tell us a little bit about the rich history of Irish golfers at the Players' Championship?
Well, Rory is the only Irish player to win a Players' Championship, and he did it in 2019. And Rory's from Northern Ireland, and I did find that although professional golfers who are from Ireland and Northern Ireland are not carrying on an ages-old grudge to the golf course, but I did find out that they appreciate it if you distinguish between where they're from, Northern Ireland or Ireland. And there have been just as many great golfers from Northern Ireland as we have had from Ireland. Rory, Graham McDowell, who had a chance to win a Players one time, had a pretty bad Sunday. And Shane Lowry is from the Ireland. But Shane Lowry and Patrick Harrington are the two best players from Ireland. Rory and Graham McDowell and Darren Clark are the best players from Northern Ireland. And for a small nation, a small island, they've had an awful lot of pretty good players. But nobody in the recent past. You will find the history of British and Scottish and American golfers go back to the turn of the 20th century. But you didn't see really good Irish players coming out until about the 1920s. And right now there are three Irish golfers, and I'll just give a hint. We'll talk about who's in the Hall of Fame. Okay, now we all know that Rory is probably going to be in the Hall of Fame one day, and Patrick Harrington is going to be inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in June in Pinehurst. But there's a career amateur named Joe Carr who played on 11 Ryder Cup, Walker Cup teams and won 42 amateur events, and he is in the Hall of Fame. He's from Dublin. And then Fred Daly, who won 28 times, was the first Irish player to win the British Open, and that was in 1947. He was also, believe it or not, in 1946, he was the first Irish player to win the Irish Open. Now, I don't know what these guys were doing letting all the British and Scots win the Irish Open before that. But there you have it. And then we also had another Hall of Fame member from Ireland is Christy O'Connor Sr., who, not to be confused with Christy O'Connor Jr., they're not father and son, they're uncle and nephew. And Christy O'Connor Sr. Was more famous for kind of his attitude in travel. He qualified for the Masters 20 times and never played. Wow. Because he thought the travel to America was going to be too difficult.
Well, back then it probably was a little bit harder than it is nowadays. But no, that's great information. And for people who are wondering, let's say you've always wondered, never looked it up. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, which encompasses Great Britain, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, which is in the northeast of the Irish Isle. And then Ireland itself is a sovereign republic. And if you ever get a chance, I've done that tour where you go through London and Liverpool and Scotland. And, you know, we went out to the Old Course and then over to Ireland. It's a great trip to do in beautiful country. So great information there, Gary. That's going to be coming out on St. Patrick's Day, the last day of the tournament. So, you know, now let's talk about weather because, you know, I can't let you go without talking about that. In early weather reports, it was looking like Saturday might be the rainiest day. Now, when you look at the models, it looks like Sunday may be a slightly rainier day. So what have you been looking into? People you're talking, what are they saying? And, you know, just kind of talk about that. You know, we've had, I believe it's 8 Monday finishes in players' history. So, you know, just give me everything you got there, Gary.
We've had some wet weather around here, and the course is right now, the superintendent told me that it's playing pretty soft, and there's not a whole heck of a lot that they can do about that. The scoring might be pretty good, and there's really no way they can get the moisture out of the golf course that's already there. If you look at the practice round days, it's going to be in the first couple of days will be in the high 60s, low 70s out at the beach and no rain, partly cloudy. And then Thursday and Friday on the first few competitive round days, it's going to be pretty decent weather. Right now we're looking at the temperature touching maybe the high 70s and maybe even 80. And then Saturday and Sunday, right now they're talking about between a 40 and 50% chance of scattered showers. Now, they can play in the rain out there, and the drainage is very good. They can play in a fairly steady rain for an extended period of time. They can't play in real heavy rain where the water starts to pool up on the greens. That's what they look for. But the minute that there's any lightning in the area, they will get fans off of there and suspend play. And I would caution fans who hear this or are going out to the tournament that there's always weather information to be found. If it looks a little bit cloudy, they'll start putting weather information up on the scoreboards to be aware that that there may be a suspension of play. And then if there is, you will hear horns going off. And if you hear one loud continuous horn, different parts of the golf course, those are rules officials with the horns. One long continuous one means get out of there. That means the dangerous weather approaching and they're about to evacuate the players and caddies and volunteers. So pay attention, pay close attention to what they're, because they know what they're doing. The tour has their own weather station out there at the Players Championship. It's out there by the, at the far end of the driving range, and they employ a full-time team of meteorologists that go from course to course. And a lot of it helps rules officials. They'll tell the rules official that there's this hole where usually the wind is in the player's face. Well, on this particular day, maybe the wind is going to be behind him, and the rules officials knows that they can back the tee up a little bit and maybe make the pin a little bit tougher to compensate for having too much wind behind him. Little things like that.
Yeah. Lord knows we heard that horn enough in 2022, Gary. I felt like I needed to bring my arc out with me, and you know, for anyone who's a soccer fan, if you saw what the women's U.S. national soccer team had to play in San Diego last week in the Gold Cup semifinal, where it looked like they were playing water polo instead of soccer, you know, these guys can play golf and a little bit of slop like that. It makes a little bit of fun. But Lord knows, we got a lot of postponements in 2022. Last year, beautiful. We'll keep an eye on what happens this upcoming week. So, you know, Gary, one last thing before I let you out of here. You know, over the course of last week from March 4th through the 8th, we released each day five parts with 10 players or 10 states in each, where you had your 50 greatest golfers, one from each, or the best golfer from all 50 states. How tough of an undertaking was that, especially from some of the more obscure states or ones that, you know, had three or four just all-time greats and you had to choose from one?
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, you know, with about a quarter of the states, maybe, it was easy. You know, look, Jack Nicklaus, greatest golfer from Ohio, Arnold Palmer from Pennsylvania, Tiger Woods from California. You know, that wasn't difficult. Surprisingly, one of my toughest ones was Connecticut. And you wouldn't think, well, how tough could it be? There are two Hall of Fame golfers from Connecticut, Julius Burrows and Doug Ford. And they pretty much had identical Hall of Fame records. And Julius Burrows got the nod because he won three majors as opposed to Doug Ford winning two. It got to where I had to break ties like that. Texas was difficult with Ben Hogan over Byron Nelson. Again, Ben won a few more tournaments and a couple of more majors than Byron Nelson. But when you get, surprisingly, when you did the research, Alaska had a five-time PGA Tour winner, a guy named Danny Edwards, who wasn't just born in Alaska and the family moved somewhere when he was two. He lived there, played all his junior golf and all his high school golf for the 3 months that you can play golf in Alaska, and somehow got noticed by Oklahoma State, which has been a powerhouse college program, and he went to Oklahoma State when he was 18, first time he left Alaska. In a couple of cases, I had to go with LPGA players like Jane Blaylock in New Hampshire, but they were deserving of it. There's no question about it. And then in two states, I had to go with amateurs. Obviously, Georgia, Bobby Jones, who's like the face of modern golf. You know, he won the two amateur majors and the two professional majors in 1 year in 1930, the only guy to ever do that. And he founded the Augusta National Golf Club. And then in West Virginia, the guy named Bill Campbell, who won between 30 and 40 amateur tournaments. He qualified for the Masters off of the U.S. Amateur, the U.S. Mid-Amateur, and being on a Walker Cup team, I believe 16 or 18 times. And he clearly the best golf. And if Bobby Jones and Bill Campbell had gone the professional route, there's no doubt that they might have had Hall of Fame professional careers.
Yeah, definitely. So make sure, again, that's all at jacksonville.com. And I want to make sure that people stay there this week. Gary, we're going to have great coverage throughout the week. We're going to have coverage into the weekend. Not only Gary Smits, who I'm talking to, is going to be there. I will be there, the editor on scene. We'll have Gene Frenette, the longtime Times Union columnist. We'll have Clayton Freeman, who is the Swiss Army knife of the Times Union. We'll have Justin Lewis, who's a great reporter out there. Full team coverage at jacksonville.com. Gary, is there anything else you'd like to get in front of the audience before I let you out of here?
Just remind people that if you're planning on going out to the tournament, then remember Friday and Saturday parking is sold out. It could be that Thursday and Sunday parking are announced early in the week as being sold out. You need to make your plans, and parking passes are separate from tournament tickets. You have to do both transactions separately. You can do it by visiting theplayers.com, but you don't get a parking pass thrown in with the admission to the tournament. There are some cases where it's private hospitality, but that's something if you had one of those tickets, then you already know that you've got a certain number of parking passes, and that won't be reflected on the PGA Tour website. Keep an eye on the weather. Download the PGA Tour app and also download the jacksonville.com app. And follow us all on social media. I'm at G Smitter, G-S-M-I-T-T-E-R. And Gene Frenette, Clayton Freeman, and have their own Twitter sites. And our paper Twitter site is jax.com. Pretty easy to remember.
Alrighty. And you know, 50 years from now, people will just be able to flip open their communicator and ask to be beamed to the Players' Championship, so parking won't be an issue. And of course, we'll have some sort of force field that can stop the rain from coming in. So let's see, in 2074, I'll be 97. Gary, you'll be about 100 and...
118, so I'm kind of hoping that somewhere in the next 20 years... we have some kind of a, you know, miracle thing to prolong life. But I promise you, if I'm around at 118, I'm not going to be out there walking the fairways. I'm going to be watching it on TV.
Well, it'll be like Futurama. You're just going to be a head in a glass jar filled with formaldehyde with a robot body. I look forward to those days because then my back won't hurt on certain days.
Yeah, I'm not sure that sounds real palatable to me, but that's okay.
All right. Well, Gary, I appreciate you coming on. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and look forward to seeing you up there on Thursday.
All right. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me.
And that will do it for this episode of the State of Florida Sports Podcast. I'm Tim Walters, and to quote three-time majors champion Jordan Spieth, I always look forward to the Players' Championship. We all approach it as if it's a major championship. It's our championship. It's really cool and on such an incredible golf course, one of the best in the world, one of my favorite in the world. Well said, Justin. Thanks for listening, and join me again next time.